You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations peoples' connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. I'm your host, Kevin, flying solo today. Anne is taking a break over summer because she worked so hard last year while I was away. She's taking a well-earned break. This week I'm all by myself, which is fine. I'm going to be delving into an interview that I conducted with Professor Bill Mitchell on the 15th of January, 2026, just recently. He was nearby, so I dropped by and had a good chat with Bill. I'll probably split the interview up into a few different segments because we talked for quite some time. The intent I had was to discuss the origins of money as we start the year by reviewing, starting modern monetary theory from the beginning and figuring out what it is and why it's important and why we need to understand modern monetary theory. And I did start or kind of ask Bill about that, but the conversation went off in a few directions. We talked about how modern monetary started, Bill and Warren Mosler met and started the movement that we now know as modern monetary theory. And, you know, we delved off into the GFC and we talked about exports and all sorts of stuff. It had its own life, this this conversation, and I was happy to let it go there because Bill is a very interesting person and is well worth listening to. So let's jump into the beginning of the interview that I conducted with Bill Mitchell just recently.
3CR, here to stay.
Welcome to Radio MMT. This week we're interviewing Professor Bill Mitchell, who is well known in MMT circles. How are you, Bill?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you, Kevin.
We haven't spoken to you for a while. What have you been up to in the recent past? Where have you been and what's happening?
Tracking where I've been, I forget where I've been. Most recently I spent some months in Japan where I work every year at Kyoto University. And, you know, that's a really interesting experience. And I'm off to Britain very soon and I've got some good events there to speak at. And but other than that, just my regular cycle of working, yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, I've spoken to you in the past and of course, you're one of the founding members of MMT. As I understand it, it was Warren Mosler and yourself that connected on an early chat line.
I'm not sure member is the right word. We're founding authors.
Yeah. And oh, that was a...
It wasn't a club.
It wasn't a club. So that would be, what, back in the 90s we're talking about?
Late 95... Early 96.
Early 96. And at that stage, the MMT movement would have had two people in
yep.
it.
Yeah. And there was no movement. There was just there was a very early internet discussion channel. Some of your listeners will remember them, these list server type email discussion channels where you had a membership, you registered with the server, and then you sent emails and it went out to all the members, and so it was fairly instantaneous communication. It revolutionised, for a young academic like me at the time, it revolutionised my ability to talk to the academy, because in the prior to that technology, we would have to send a snail mail, and to someone we wanted to communicate with, like another economist in my case.
Yeah, I guess we sort of take it for granted these days, don't we? But this is the 90s. We're talking about dial-up internet, DOS, some fairly pioneering sort of computer technology.
Yeah, very early dial-up, all text, no graphics.
Yeah.
Virtually the beginnings of hypertext, so links.
Right, yeah.
World Wide Web links weren't a feature then. And this was a great idea that you'd have to, prior to that, you'd send out a snail mail and you'd have to wait 3 months for a reply. With these list servers, you could get a reply back in virtually, if the person wanted to reply straight away.
And this was the whole optimism of the internet back in the day, that it was going to open up these marvellous lines of communication and the world would be a far better place because of all of the free-flowing information in the world.
Well, it was that time. It started as an open source movement. The corporations weren't there, and it was a fantastic vehicle for communities to. There was no social media as such. It was just these email lists were the communication protocols, and it was a fantastic resource to bring communities. And it was the academy and the military that engaged with it first, obviously.
Right.
Just because of that's the way technology access occurs initially, but so it was that at the beginning. It was probably the summer, Australian summer of 95, 96, that during these discussions on this particular list, it was called the Post-Keynesian Theory List.
Right.
I ran into Warren Mosler, who was not an academic, and he had gone onto the list to check out some ideas that he had to see who else had them. And it turned out there was only one other person really that had them, that was me, from the academic side. He was a Wall Street banker, like he's got not an academic at all, totally. Yeah.
But he had the same kind of rationale and logic that you had formed yourself.
I'd formed the logic through academic means, through research and logic and nutting it out from a theoretical point of view.
Yeah.
He had formed the logic from doing it.
Right.
Trading in the financial markets, dealing with central banks.
He was dealing with bonds and stuff, is that correct?
He was a bond trader, government bond trader.
Right.
And he was speculating on bond yields and bond prices. And so he had to work with treasury departments, like government treasury departments. So he had to work with central banks in terms of foreign exchange, etc. And he had worked out these principles on the basis of what happened in reality.
Yeah, so he's looking from an academic point of view, but from a real life point of view as to how money is created and bonds, etc.
How the financial system and the monetary system actually operates.
You're on 3CR, listening to Radio MMT. I'm your host, Kevin. This week we're speaking to Professor Bill Mitchell, who has a position at Kyoto University with their economic forecasting. I interviewed him not long ago. He's been talking about the history of Japanese economics. Bill has an interest in Japan because although Japan, like many other economies, it's a democratic capitalist economy. It has its own sovereign currency, the yen. However, it seems to be not so beholden to the monetary policy, interest rates, as other neoliberal economies like Australia and the US, etc. Japan is not afraid to use its fiscal policy, government spending, to support its economy. It runs continuous large deficits. It kept interest rates low during the recent worldwide inflation episode without experiencing any of the dire consequences predicted by the neoliberal economic orthodoxy. Despite an ageing and shrinking population, Japan continues to survive economically despite all the doomsayers. And it's this emphasis that it places on fiscal policy that interests Bill because it's very much aligns with the MMT understanding of how economies actually run, especially when you consider that a government creates its own currency and it should apply that fiscal capacity to support its economy far more than it does and far more than the orthodoxy would lead us to believe. So let's continue this interview with Professor Bill Mitchell. From a meeting of two people in late 1995, we now have you freshly back from Japan where you're influencing people over there at a fairly significant level.
Well, that's a matter of contention, who you ask, but I think that the ideas have traction and in certain places, and in Japan certainly my colleague at Kyoto University, he's one of the senior advisors to the new Prime Minister, Ms. Takaichi. Ms. Takaichi came into that job recently and has indicated she wanted to make a break with the Ishiba austerity type mentality. He was the previous, Shigeru Ishiba was the previous Prime Minister. And my research colleague Satoshi Fuji and myself, was one of her senior advisors. We gave a talk in the Diet, so that's the parliament, and we were urging a much larger fiscal expansion than Takeuchi had initially indicated would be the break from the Ishiba austerity type approach. So we had a very nice workshop at a symposium at the Diet in Tokyo. It was attended by a lot of parliamentarians, members of the government and members of the cabinet. And we were urging a much larger expansion. They wanted to expand 15.4 trillion or something like that. And I was saying, look, it's got to be close to 50 trillion.
Right, okay.
That's yen.
Yep.
Yen, which is not a very large expansion, by the way.
Well, that's more than three times than what they're suggesting. So
But what they were suggesting wasn't very large.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, it's how, you know, when you're in Japan, everything's big in monetary terms because of the... Divide that by 100 and you've got Australian dollars.
Okay, right, yeah.
So it was about 2% of GDP, something like that.
It's a fair amount of money.
It needed to be because Japan is, and we can talk about it, but Japan's caught in a structural stagnation and it needs to be shocked. Right. Anyway, the point I'm making is that within 2 days of that symposium and a lot of conversations afterwards with a lot of people in government, and their advisors, etc., they upped the expansion to 21.3 trillion.
Which is increasing it by 30% or thereabouts. And the result of that is that there's that extra money flowing into the economy that has a significant impact on, well, hopefully will have a significant impact on people's lives, real lives.
Yes. The issue of Japan is that, I mean, a brief history of Japan. It embraced neoliberalism mega in 1980s. It had all of the financial market hubris that we all had, but it had it on steroids. Its property market, particularly its commercial property market in the large cities like Osaka and Tokyo and Kobe and Nagasaki, these real estate prices just went crazy. and asset prices generally, financial asset prices generally went crazy. It was unsustainable, like all of these bubbles, these speculative bubbles that it's really like pass the parcel.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everybody thinks they won't be caught with the parcel. And so in early 1991, the whole system really collapsed.
Right.
It was a dramatic collapse. The commercial real estate values plunged.
Is that something that we would recognise as similar to happening with the GFC?
Similar GFC, yeah. Bigger than the GFC for Japan. It happened during the 91 recession. It was right. A global recession.
Yep.
If you remember the recession we had to have
in
Australia, it was the largest downturn since the Great Depression. And that scorched Japan's bubble. That just completely pricked the bubble.
Right.
And so the question was then, what was going to happen? Well, interestingly, the Japanese changed direction, and that's where you started to see the large fiscal deficit. So government spending much more than they were taking out of the economy and taxation.
Right.
If Australia had have had a real estate collapse like they had, we would have had a very deep recession. The point I'm making is that in Japan, because they responded in a very positive way, they had one quarter of negative GDP.
Right.
Because the government's deficit went up substantially.
So the government's spending into the economy and creating activity and hopefully activity in the right areas, that's always contentious.
Yeah, it did. The problem, though, was that the damage to the private sector was so large that pessimism ruled, and corporations, you know, they became very pessimistic about the future. So they started hoarding profits as retained earnings rather than reinvesting.
Yep.
The business investment rate fell, and in turn they were reluctant to pay higher wages.
Okay.
So Japan had up until then a system of what we call in English lifetime employment.
Right.
So this is the salary man who...
Right, so is that typically like, you know, you have a career for life
forever,
that you're working
for
the same firm?
Yeah, and firms, I mean, when I speak to business people in Japan, you know, one-on-one, they tell me that the last thing they ever want to do is sack someone.
Right.
That, you know, unlike us, we'll just tell the person to shoot through without compunction, but in Japan it's a last resort.
So they have a lot more human empathy for
it's a solidaristic society, and the sort of neoliberal individualism that we all run ourselves on hasn't broken through as much in Japan at all.
So there's a sense of societal responsibility if you're Japanese.
It's a solidaristic society that you worry about your neighbour, and everything you do you evaluate it on the basis of the impact on the other person. Anyway, the problem then was that because the firms were so pessimistic and stopped investing and just hoarding all this money, when people retired or left, they wouldn't replace them with a permanent worker.
Right, okay.
So you started to get the... what's called non-regular work in Japan.
And right.
So, I mean, it's the same we've seen here, the casualisation of the part-time workers and...
It's rare to have a long-time job. Most people work for 4 or 5 years and then change. Still a few people around. There's a couple of people I know who've been working for decades in the same job, but they're rare these days.
Yeah, I mean, Japan wasn't immune to these global trends, the neoliberal trends of casualisation, precarious work, rise of the service sector, you know, the gig economy, hospitality and food and all of that. And so what you ended up with was an economy that was stuck in a very low growth cycle. Businesses weren't reinvesting their profits, which they would normally do.
Right.
And wages were then flat. Price inflation was virtually negative because there was so muted demand.
So everybody's cautious, nobody's...
Everybody's just locked in this cycle of pessimism and stagnation. And there's been bumps along the road and that's pervasive in Japan, that cultural negativity.
So that's now entrenched in Japanese society.
So the argument that we made to the cabinet at this symposium I mentioned was that human psychology has to be shocked out of that. There has to be a major change. The Japanese government has, at various periods, tried incremental shifts to push the economy along and get wages moving, and they've always failed to permanently alter the psychology of the community, business and consumers and households. And so our argument was that you need a one-off major shock that gives the businesses an incentive.
An opportunity.
The feeling that this time's different.
Okay. Right,
and gives households the idea that, yes, we're in a new era. And see, households save a lot in Japan.
That's part of the cautious attitude.
It's partly that. I mean, it's partly also that their social security system isn't as consolidated as ours is, for example. So you save for your old age. But it's also the fact that their houses are much smaller and they can't stuff as much junk.
There's not as much consumerism because
there's not a big boat out in the driveway with the three or four SUVs in the driveway of a huge house that's ridiculously large. So that's one reason. But the major reason that had to be broken was this pessimism, and that's why we recommended a major structural shock to break it out of what we call secular stagnation. And only the government can do that. Think about the Great Depression. They needed a major expansion and they got it.
Yeah.
And then they got a second one. The unintended one came in the late 30s when everyone went to war.
Right. Yeah.
And it was only really the war that ended the Great Depression, because the governments had to spend so much on prosecuting, you know, weapons and stuff that ended the Second War, ended the Great Depression. But nobody ever wants to be in on any false pretenses. That's what happened. The government came in, shocked an economy that was stuck.
Yeah,
the capitalist economy, and you know, Marx knew this, and certainly John Maynard Keynes knew it. The capitalist economy is prone to crises, and it can get stuck. Even in a deep crisis, the market, as we call it now, it doesn't provide any signals in a deep crisis for the private sector to change their behaviour. And so what happens is that in a deep crisis, firms go broke, of course, but the firms that remain in solvent, they reach a state where they're selling what they expect to sell, and so there's no further incentive for them to change their behaviour. And this could be when unemployment's 20%, 10%, 5%, you know.
Yeah.
And so you need something from outside of that private spending cycle to come in and push that economy out of its so-called steady state into a new plane of activity. And only the government can do that.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
You are indeed listening to 3CR. You're listening to Radio MMT. My name is Kevin. I'm presenting. You might be listening on the radio, on the 855 AM band. You might be streaming us on the internet, or you might be listening to the podcast. Either way, you're listening to us, and that's good. This week, we are replaying an interview I did with Professor Bill Mitchell, who, among other things, holds a position with Kyoto University in their economics department. He does forward planning and working with their economic advisors, who then advise the government. He's been explaining some of the history of the Japanese economy, and he's been telling us about how he's been working with the team that is promoting the government to spend more into the economy to stimulate it. This is of particular interest to MMTers. Bill, of course, is one of the founders of MMT, and we're seeing here modern monetary theory turn into modern monetary practice, because Bill understands that as the government is the currency issuer, it's the body that creates money, and that relying on the private sector and relying on monetary policy and interest rates to control the economy is dubious, to say the least. So Japan defies a lot of the other capitalist economies in its practice of promoting government spending and using the government to keep the economy afloat, which is all very interesting. But it might be time for a bit of a music break. Let's have a listen to Toots and the Maytals with their song Funky Kingston.
Bye.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're on Radio MMT, which is on 3CR, which is a community radio station. And just like the announcement said, download the Community Radio Plus app, because community radio stations by nature are varied in their programming. And you don't always want to listen to the same station the whole time. And when you've got the app, you can flick in between the different community radio stations and find something that you like, because the best shows are on community radio. It's just not always convenient to listen to all the shows in a row. Now, today we are speaking about the origins of money. That was the intention. And to that end, I interviewed Professor Bill Mitchell not long ago. So the next part of the show has to do with government as a currency issuer. But then that fell over into foreign currency. And then we wandered into banking and we started talking about deficits and surpluses, which eventually led us into the Howard and Costello government, Howard and Costello ran a series of surpluses, which was an unusual time. So the conversation does meander, and it meanders from a kind of layperson's understanding of economics into, I'd call it a medium or moderate understanding. It gets a bit technical sometimes. I have tried to keep the conversation as accessible as possible. But, when you're speaking to a fully qualified professor of economics, sometimes the conversation can go into some territory. I hope you can stay with us. Anyway, let's continue the conversation that I had with Professor Bill Mitchell just recently. It seems to me that the logical starting point, if you're talking about modern monetary theory, is to talk about money, where it comes from. And so what you're saying here is that if you need substantial change, if you need dynamics to shift, trying to rely on the market is not going to do that. You need government to become involved. And I'd suggest that that's because money comes from the government. It's government that creates money. And we often hear how markets create money and how we need businesses to be functioning properly, to make money. But they don't make money, they use money, they accumulate money. If you want to know who makes money, it's the government. They create the currency and they inject it into the economy. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, that's reasonable. I mean, the Australian households and firms use the Australian dollar in their transactions, and the only entity in the Australian economy that can issue that Australian dollar is the federal government via the central bank. The private businesses can't create it, households can't create it. We use that currency, and that has that dichotomy between issuer and user has substantial implications that most people don't appreciate, which formed the starting point of the modern monetary theory or the MMT journey.
Yeah, because the story that we hear told time and time again, I've listened to Barnaby Joyce on the TV occasionally when he pops his head up through gritted teeth and he's telling us that the Australian economy is entirely dependent on selling coal. We need the money that comes from exporting coal to keep our economy afloat. And from that, you sort of get this impression that there's these Australian dollars out there somewhere, and that if we sell coal, those Australian dollars will appear from somewhere and boost our economy. That's kind of how it feels. Now I know he might have a more educated understanding of that, but it's not...
I doubt it in his case, but but I mean, that's a separate issue, the one you're mentioning, the export issue.
It kind of
creates this impression. We don't know where Australian dollars come from, but if we sell coal, these Australian dollars will come from somewhere and boost our economy. It creates a false narrative, really, or a misinformed view.
I mean, the way to understand it is that the Australian government, federal government, is the issuer of the currency, the Australian dollar. No other entity is. You can't get it from anywhere else. There's a limitation inherent in that, is that, yeah, the government can issue the currency, but it can only use that currency to buy things that are available for sale in that currency. Now, if we want to buy Toyota cars from Japan, the Toyota company want to be paid in yen, Japanese currency. And so the Australian government or a household or a firm that has the Australian dollars, they can't just go up to Toyota and say, oh, we want a Toyota Corolla, please. Here's some Australian dollars. That's not going to work. And I'm abstracting here from the whole dealership, wholesaler network. I'm just thinking in terms of a direct relationship between the consumer and the factory in Japan. And so the whole trade thing is a further complication that a nation that issues its own currency, the government of that nation can always buy whatever is for sale in that currency, including all labour that hasn't got a job. But that's the limitation.
Yep.
And if the nation wants to buy things that are for sale, but not in Australian dollars, in a foreign currency, then we've got to get some foreign currency. One way to get foreign currency is to export things, and that way we get the wherewithal, the foreign currency reserves, to then buy imports, which we need or want. And so that's a complication. Barnaby Joyce wouldn't probably say it like that.
No.
But when we're talking about export revenue, we're really talking about getting the capacity to buy imports.
If two countries want to trade, then each country has to have something of value to the other if the currencies are going to hold any value. That's kind of how I understand it. If Japan has cars and Australia has iron ore, then you'll have an ability to transfer yen into Australian dollars and back again. But in both cases, the yen has to be created by the Japanese government and the Australian dollar has to be created by the Australian government before any of this stuff can happen.
Yep. There has to be the sovereign currencies in circulation.
Yeah. So for that money to enter the economy, for those Australian dollars to enter the economy or for the yen to enter the economy, both governments have to spend that money into existence, which is to say that they have to have a priority where they want to purchase something. When they decide that they want to purchase something, they instruct their central bank to transfer money.
It can't happen any other way. So one thing about the layperson perception is that, oh, don't you get the money from the bank? Don't they give you money? But yes, of course they do. And they lend you money. But ultimately, they get the actual currency from the government.
Yeah, banking's an interesting concept, which actually took me quite some time to get my head around. When I found out that banks can actually create Australian dollars, I thought, hang on, isn't that just the government? So the government will create Australian dollars when it decides to buy some submarines, or when it decides to pay pension checks, or pay its public servants. Whatever it needs to spend, it will then create dollars by paying these people. We call that spending that money into existence. And banking had me confused for quite some time, but then I realised that a bank is an interface which has a relationship with the government, and they will advance you money that you will earn in the future in terms of credit. And they'll say, if you can prove to us that you will access money in the future from the supply of money, which is supplied by the government via its deficits, if you're able to fulfil those requirements, then we will advance you money and you will pay us back with interest in the future. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I mean, a slightly more technical way of thinking about it, which we can still keep at the lay level.
It's a layperson show,
Bill. We can still keep it at lay level. Yeah. Is that when the government spends, there's just an asset created in the non-government sector where we live, you and me.
The economy.
The economy.
Yeah.
Well, no, not, it's not the economy. It's the non-government section of the economy.
I'm actually purposely trying to just have very broad descriptions of things. So it's the part of the economy which we refer to as the non-government sector.
Yeah, it's the households and firms.
Yeah.
And everything that's non-government. So when the government spends into the economy, in other words, spends into the non-government sector, that's an asset is created. It's a net effect. It's a positive effect. And when it taxes and takes money out of the economy, there's money is reduced in the non-government sector.
So money's extinguished through tax.
Extinguished through tax.
I'll follow this up later on, but we'll stick with this.
Yeah, I hope you don't. But but given our prior our conversation the other day.
Well,
but
it's about currency creation.
I know.
Yeah, so.
So we call them government to non-government transactions. Then they have a net effect. Whereas a transaction within the non-government sector, you going to your bank and asking for a loan, that doesn't create any net effect in financial terms. Now, so why not? Well, because you go and ask your bank for a $100 loan, it creates an asset for itself, the loan,
yeah,
and it creates an equal financial liability, the loan.
Which cancel each other out.
No net effect.
Right.
There's obviously spending power created. The bank types in some numbers into computers. You get purchasing power of $100 to go and buy whatever you wanted for the loan, but you also get an equal liability. So in terms of financial terms, there's no net effect. It cancels out.
When the loan is paid off?
Well, when the loan is paid off, the bank loses its asset.
Yeah.
It writes its asset down and you lose your liability, and so it nets out to zero. The point is that there's a fundamental difference between these monetary transactions that occur within the private sector and the monetary transactions that occur between the currency issuer and the currency user, the government sector and the non-government sector.
Right.
There's a fundamental difference.
Okay.
And so, yeah, the bank can create purchasing power, liquidity, by creating credit, but in net terms, in financial terms, it nets out to zero.
So the accounting description of that zeros itself out.
You're on Radio MMT with your host, Kevin. When we get into the academic stuff, I do admit I begin to glaze over. It's important to know. It helps with understanding how money works, etc. But I do still glaze over. I'm not an academic. We've been listening to an interview that I conducted with Bill Mitchell on Thursday the 15th of January, just a short time ago. We've been talking about currency creation, about banking, about foreign currency. We did wander off there for a bit. Let's continue on. I started this part of the interview on the assumption that governments needed to run deficits in order for bank customers to fulfil their credit obligations in the future. The logic being that when governments run deficits, that money flows through into the economy and people who have bank credit need to repay their loans, and that they would be accessing money that I presume could only come from deficits, which was generally speaking true. However, Bill educated and informed me, so we'll pick up the interview from that point of the conversation. The other thing which I also find interesting about bank credit arrangements is that for people to fulfill their obligations in repaying loans, they need governments to keep on running deficits so that they can acquire the money in the future to facilitate those loans. And I've never heard a bank promoting the idea that governments should run deficits so that their business can stay afloat. To me, they would probably argue the opposite cause. But then
what you've just said isn't exactly true.
Right, okay. step me through it.
Imagine an economy that exports a lot. So Norway's a good example. It has huge North Sea gas and oil reserves.
Right.
So it's getting a lot of financial input from other countries.
Right.
Who it sells the gas and oil to.
Yeah.
You know, that's adding what we call spending or demand to the economy.
So Norway typically runs surpluses.
External surpluses. In other words, they sell more stuff, in their case, energy, than they import.
Are those external surpluses, are they denominated in foreign currencies?
Well, this is the complication, you see, and trying to deal with these topics at a lay level is quite difficult because there's so much prior understanding you have to have.
Sure, sure.
So the point is that, okay, Norway sells the gas and oil. It's like Toyota sells the car.
Yeah.
Now, ultimately, the manufacturer, in the Toyota case, Japan, they want to have yen because typically their costs will be in local currency and their revenue will be in foreign currency.
Right.
So they've got a mismatch of currency which exposes them to what we call exchange rate risk.
Rightio.
What that means is that their revenue can fluctuate not because of the contract but because of the exchange rate effect.
Right.
So they could be expecting a whole lot of money coming in their local currency to match it against their costs which are paid out, their wages and stuff that are paid out in local currency. Yet the exchange rate could shift against them and so suddenly their expected revenue will be much lower. And that's a major problem for companies that trade. And that's why financial markets offer what's called hedging and future contracts.
Right.
What those manufacturers do is offload that exchange rate risk to a speculator, a risk taker, who then bets on the exchange rate moving in a direction that will favour them. So that's a complication. But the point is that Norway and Japan want yen or krona. Ultimately, that's what they want. They know that if they're selling into export markets, there will be a foreign exchange transaction occur because their sales will be in a foreign currency. Now, that's not exclusively true because a lot of contracts are denominated in euro or US dollar. Like 51%, I think, at the moment, of all trading is done in US dollars. Even if the country's engaging in the trade, don't use the US dollar themselves.
Right. It's just set as the international currency.
Now, the euro is becoming more important.
Yep.
And the Chinese currency, the yuan, is becoming more important. But it's still the fact that over the majority of transactions in world trade markets are in US dollars.
I think Donald Trump, in his international mindset, is trying to make the world a more level playing field by decreasing the popularity of the US dollar.
No, well, that's a separate debate whether he is or he isn't. No. I don't think he wants to do that, but that could be what's happening.
It might be the result regardless.
The point I'm making is that the export revenue will ultimately, by hook or by crook, get converted back into local currency because the exporter wants local currency. Ultimately.
Right.
So whether the contract's in US dollars or some other currency, ultimately the exporter will seek to convert that back into local currency. Now, that's done in financial markets in a variety of ways. It's labyrinthic the way that can occur, and it requires third parties and counterparties and all of the other stuff, taking risk and conversion and the rest of it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the Norwegian exporter gets local currency back, and that stimulates the economy. So the question then is, a government could be running a surplus and the economy would still be generating growth.
Right.
Because you've got so much money coming in from outside the economy.
So, but that would be the exception to the rule. We're talking about Norway, and there might be one or two other examples that might pop their heads up occasionally.
Yeah, Germany's a large exporter. China's a large exporter. Japan runs external surpluses. Korea.
But generally speaking, getting back to this is a bit like a Billy Connolly joke where you head off down these rabbit holes and you forget where you started. The point that I had raised was that for banks to be confident that their customers could meet the obligations of their credit arrangements, government deficits are important in that relationship.
They may be important.
Generally speaking, if you're not Norway,
I mean, government deficits for most countries have to be continuous and the norm. So the general statement is the banks want the economy to be generating income growth and employment growth, so that the borrower is able to have the wherewithal to pay back its loan. So the question then is, well, what generates employment and income and production and GDP growth? Well, that depends upon the nature of the economy. For some economies, they can do that without government deficits.
If you're Norway? Or
if you're a big exporter.
Yeah.
For most countries, they can't do that. And, you know, this is really significant in recent Australian history that most of your listeners will be familiar with. In 1996, the Howard Costello government was elected on the back of lurid statements about how they were sick of the government debt and it was killing the economy and it was choking our future generations and
hanging over our kids and our
grandkids and all of that stuff. And so that they dutifully went about running surpluses through their austerity, and as the debt matured, they didn't renew it. And so eventually government debt started to disappear.
Which means there's no bonds being issued.
Yeah, so that's right.
Government deficits, for the lay listener, government deficits are matched by the government issuing bonds to the...
Yeah, and the way the narrative that we're sold is that those bonds create the currency for the government to run the deficits, but it's actually the opposite way around.
Yep.
Because once you understand that the government doesn't need the currency from the bond investors, it spends its own currency, well then there must be another reason for issuing debt, but that's a separate issue.
And it's an important issue to understand, though, is the 180 degree change of view when you understand that the government is a currency issuer and it's not dependent on tax revenue or bond issuance, then the whole bond situation, which can become quite complicated, actually becomes quite clear.
I mean, it's quite clear that they don't need to issue debt to spend, whereas if we want to spend more than our income as a household, for example, because we use the currency, and what that means is we have a financial constraint on our spending that the federal government doesn't have. And so if we want to spend more, like to buy a house, than our current income, then we have to go into debt, whereas the government doesn't have to do that at all. But the point we're making here is that during those brief 11 years of Australian history, financial history, where they ran 10 surpluses, that's been held out as the norm. That, we keep talking about budget repair and we keep getting the government back into surplus.
That we should aspire to this rare moment of history where a government ran successive surpluses as if that's the goal.
Yeah, and
ignores the history of governments.
Yeah, 90% of our recorded financial history, the government has run deficits. To put a finer point on that, though, the only reason that Costello, as the treasurer, federal treasurer, was able to run those surpluses 10 out of 11 years was because the financial market deregulation meant that the household sector started to go crazy with credit. And if you remember back to that period, credit cards would just appear for children in mailboxes with large credit limits, and people were boasting you could go down and get a meal before 10 o'clock from the bank without question. And so household debt went from about 60% of disposable income to 180%. The point about that was that household debt allowed for consumption to grow faster than normal, and that growth gave the government abnormal tax revenue growth. And so while the government was cutting back on spending through its neoliberal austerity, it was getting a tax revenue boom because of the household debt was driving consumption growth. And then, of course, the government was very lucky historically, because you then had the once in a 100-year mining boom.
So they're getting royalties from mining, and not to mention the fact that they sold Telstra and the rest of the Qantas.
That was somewhat minor.
I thought that was a significant part of their...
That was a major issue in terms of quality of institutional life in Australia.
I was of the understanding that the money that they raised from those sales was...
Not as significant as the tax revenue that they got from the spending growth from households first and then the mining.
That's where we're going to have to leave the show for today. We've run out of time. Thanks for joining us. We've been speaking with Professor Bill Mitchell, and we'll pick up this conversation in our next episode of Radio MMT. Until then, see you later.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomics band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
We're going to do the regression theory of money to music.
That'll work. That's good. Regression theory of money. What rhymes with regression? Regression, depression, instant. There's a world of opportunity. Have you ever sung before in a band?
No, you do not want to hear me sing, Kevin.
What's the next
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.